to this is May Day. And the ladies in the Senate and some of the men are celebrating May Day today. And so if you go over to the Senate, you will see hats. And your chair donned her hat today. This is May 1st, 2003, Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, and we're holding our public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Department-wide Support Services. And I want to, because this lovely bear was given to me when I came through the hall, and it's from a child I love to a child you love. Please remember, any child can be born with a disability. And it says, it's been wonderful to see Christopher's speech improve as much as it has, and I'm also so thankful for providing such a positive classroom experience for him. Today, if you're here, you will probably see a lot of teddy bears with a lot of notes to remind us of children with disabilities. So just wanted to put that on record, and it does match my red and white today. With that, John is with us on with the Office of Information Services and Pam, and we will continue where we left off on Wednesday.
Good afternoon again today. My name is John Cuddy, and I'm the Chief Information Officer of the department. And, Madam Chair, what I'd like to do, if it's okay, is in the interest of time, we have a few more things on the challenges section of the presentation, but I'd like to skip those and come back to them later if there's time. And, of course, if there are questions on stuff that we don't get through, if any of you would like to contact me or contact the department, we'd be happy to try to answer those for you. What we'd like to try to do then today is jump to page 13, which is the conversation that we wanted to have with you about the Medicaid Management Information System Replacement Project. And just for a little background before I introduce Rick Howard, this project was first approved in the 1999 legislature, or by the 1999 legislature, and then was approved again for continuation and more funding in the 2001 legislature. And this is a multi-biennium project. It is very big and is absolutely crucial to the department, and we want to make sure we do it right and take our time, not delay a lot, but not rush through it either. So it is a multi-year and multi-biennium project. We have in this biennium, and actually in the one before, reported on a regular basis about the headway we were making to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, the JLCIMT. And so we've been reporting on a regular basis to them about where we are. And what we'd like to do today is a couple of things. First of all, we'd like to give you some sense from the program perspective, from the OMAP's perspective, about why we need this and how it's going to help with managing and operating the Medicaid program better, and some of the issues around that. And then I'm going to talk briefly toward the tail end about the status of the project and kind of where we are and where we're headed over the next couple of years. So with that, let me introduce Rick Howard from OMAP.
Good afternoon, Chair Winters, members of the committee. I'm Rick Howard. I'm the Health Financing Operations Manager for OMAP. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the basic problem that we confront with an obsolete and aging MMIS system.
I probably should make one announcement just in case, and that is we continue to have with us Rosie and Rosette, and who collects for acronyms, alphabet soups, and when we forget to state the full meaning of alphabets. So
I understand, Chair Winters, and I have donated my money in advance for sins I will no doubt commit in the course of my testimony. So she's well fed by me already. And notwithstanding John's comments about the Toastmasters, you can count my us and you knows as I go, I am not a member and in no way reflects upon the activities of the OIS Toastmasters.
Oregon Food Bank appreciates all the donations.
The Medicaid Management Information System, MMIS, does limit our ability to administer the state's Medicaid program as efficiently as possible. And this is the basic problem that we face on a day-to-day basis. I want to begin by talking about some of those problems with the existing MMIS and then move on to the what we expect that the MMIS replacement will do, the benefits that will be derived from that project as it rolls out. In a nutshell, and I believe, Chair Winters, you were alluding to it yesterday, we have a system that is old, and it was built in the mid-1970s. I believe it was for the state of Missouri. I'm not sure about that. And it came to us in 1982. It was transferred, much like the proposed approach that for the new system. So we have some experience in the transfer of a data system to this state. It puts it over 20 years old. And what we have are increasingly complex business requirements that exceed the original design specifications of the Medicaid Management Information System as it was built. There were substantial modifications required in 1993 to support the managed care aspects of the Oregon Health Plan. This is speaking to the question you raised yesterday, Chair Winters. What is the basic problem? What happened at the time that the OHP was developed that so fundamentally changed the parameters of this system that we had purchased? And it really boils down to the flow of money, that health care and the services associated with it were paid in a traditional fee-for-service environment up front, after the service was rendered. When we moved with the Oregon Health Plan with its emphasis on managed care, we had to modify the system in such a way that we could pay for services in advance through the form of capitated payments. That facilitated bringing providers, managed care organizations, into the system, figuring out how we were going to pay them in block sums of money through capitation payments in advance of the services, and then collect the encounter data that would be submitted as a result of those services. It's a fundamental difference from a system that was designed to pay for services already rendered to pay for services in advance of them being rendered. Quite simply, you have a very complex and integrated system that now had these subsystems placed onto it, subsystem being, say, managed care enrollment. So you end up with some very difficult problems with these systems that don't quite talk to each other in an efficient way and result in the kind of problems we're seeing today in that system. When we, as a result of that, we, of course, no program stays static. We are now always modifying our delivery system, the Oregon Health Plan. As you're aware, we really
How many different steps did it require when you went to managed care? Because on one system, you're talking about paying claims or paying it after the fact, and the other system you're doing before, and then you're trying to take when the encounter data is when the service actually occurred. So how many additional steps does that require?
Chair Winters, in terms of the steps, and is it a matter, question center on an individual who are trying to enroll in a managed care plan, or the steps are required once?
Well, you have the enrollment, and then, you know, in the fee-for-service system, you had a certain number of steps that you had to take for data input. In the managed care system, I would think you also have some steps that you probably would do more than you would in the previous system.
Well, the additional work, in answer to your question, Chair Winters, is involved in how do you put people in plans, and then the churn rates, the movement through the plans between the different delivery systems, the encounter data has a different level of quality. It's hard for me to think in terms of steps so much as increase administrative load.
Okay. Well, let's say load. How much load did it increase?
Gosh. Well, we saw an additional 100,000 people come on February 1st of 1994, and in that first year, I believe the number went to 150,000. So you had just an increased capacity, more people who ordinarily would not have been receiving Medicaid certainly stressed the system. Now paying for those additional folks, plus fee-for-service folks who moved over to managed care, cutting the capitation checks, getting the rate groups assigned, keeping them in those plans for as long as possible, all of this increased it on an order of magnitude. I really can't answer that specifically. But I think I've seen figures of an additional 50-60% suddenly came along with this increase in the population in terms of just workload. But I can get back to you on the specifics, sure. I'd be glad to. Okay. One of the things that probably is most frustrating is our inability to respond as quickly as we would like to the kind of initiatives, especially the cost containment initiatives that come to us from the legislature. An idea is put forth, it's looked at, analyzed, is determined to be a sound idea for cost savings and cost containment, and then trying to implement that on an aging with an aging system really at times can delay the full effect of that, costing us lost savings for every day that goes by that we can't respond to implementing that initiative. So really becomes a problem where the system is so inflexible that the kind of flexibility in the requirements that we need in a dynamic environment, there's a big disconnect there. This lack of flexibility does pose some risks. They pose risks in the form of reduced federal funding and also in ever-increasing, escalating maintenance costs. Like any old system, whether it's an older car or an older mainframe computer, you start to put money into it just to keep it around. And that's where we're at now. We have a huge backlog of just service requests. The service request is a request by a user to put a fix into the system. We currently have 650 of these requests, and if we were to try to address them all and implement them, we have over 100,000 hours of production time, of workforce time. About 60 FTEs would be required just to fix all of the things that people would like to see. We would expect the MMIS replacement would not only incorporate some of these shortcomings that we would like to see fixed in the MMIS, but would also be flexible enough that as new changes came along, the design system would be the design of the new Medicaid Management Information System would be such that we would not see that kind of backlog increase to the degree it has. Our oldest service request is back to 1986. It will never be worked on, but it's on the log. And that gives you a sense of the magnitude when you start talking about just how difficult it is to keep this system as responsive as we would like to not only our changing business needs but to the changing environment. It really presents a difficulty. In the past 90 days alone, the cost containment initiatives we've seen in copay implementation, the OHP2 program rollout, premium determination have been hampered by these inflexibility of the MMIS. So it really, it's not that we wouldn't like to do these things quicker. The system really doesn't help us in that area. Also, the SIRS component, if you think of the MMIS as a series of subsystems, this surveillance, utilization, and review system component, federal requirement to, among other things, check for fraud and abuse, has been out of compliance for a number of years, since 1995. A new project has come along to take MMIS data and turn it into a data warehouse that will help bring us into compliance from the federal perspective and allow us to be more responsive, increase our ability to detect fraud and abuse, prevent overpayments, and help us in the general area of recoveries.
What is our overpayment rate?
Well, back when DSERS was coming along, we had in 1994 when it was first proposed, it was in terms of fraud, it was calculated to be. This was calculated by KPMG, Pete Marwick, one of the consultants we had in development of DSERS, was calculated to be 672 $300,000. They're projecting that we would see in the second year of the operation for our new surveillance utilization review system to be $1 million. And over a five-year period, we hope to collect $4 million in terms of increased SERS revenues. Made a lot of sense to go forward with that. And that SERS component is not money that was spent that we won't see back. That is a feature of the new MMIS replacement. It will build upon that the SERS component that the state has already paid for and will be implemented here, and we expect in September of this year. The modifications that are required to be responsive to legislative initiatives and to just answer basic questions sometimes are really very difficult to implement. You touch one portion of the system and you think you've fixed it, and another part of the system will suddenly choke, and you can't. Now you're left dealing with two problems and not just one. So it is such a complex system, as John alluded to, the millions and millions of lines of programming code. It's very hard to alter anything without seeing where that might play out. There are technological barriers that compromise our timely and accurate use of Medicaid data, whether we're trying to do mass adjustments for paid claims, enrollment of clients into inappropriate Medicaid programs, and just the data integrity problems that contribute to stakeholders' frustration. We have a lack of data integration. It's very hard to take eligibility information and work with other programs in order to properly administer and control the enrollment and the utilization patterns of the people who touch the Medicaid program. Data such as financial information, demographic statistics, they're not readily available for analysis and reporting. I know this has been a source of frustration for many people to ask what would be seemingly a fairly simple question about some fundamental aspect of the Medicaid program and its operations often requires quite a bit of work to get that information out of the system. So again, with the idea that coming up with a replacement for the MMIS system will allow the type of inquiries that are made from the Medicaid or presented to the Medicaid program, we would be able to get to them quicker.
My telephone just came in. What page are you
on? I'm sorry, I am on, members of the committee, I am on page 13 and moving to page 14 of this very rapid oversight of the MMIS replacement. Or overview of the MMIS replacement. So, that without painting too big of a picture of doom and gloom, I'm going to move on to the benefits of a modern Medicaid management information system. What do we expect to get out of this new system? We do expect to see efficiencies obtained, streamlining the administrative and operational processes. We will improve the state's ability to detect fraud and abuse. We're making a big step toward that here with the surveillance and utilization review system that's coming online. It will only continue to, as the data integrity improves with a new MMIS system, our ability to make the fullest use of the new tool we're getting will only increase. It's going to decrease the frequency of inaccurate payments. Facilitate the quick recovery of overpayments. Again, MMIS system as it stands, there are portions of it where when we make recoveries on a claim, it may not make it back into the system for posting. And we, in an effort, this is in an effort to reconcile these monies that are ultimately collected through the so-called pay and chase function, will be integrated into the new MMIS system. It will help us promote the efficient and effective allocation of human and financial resources. Right now, in an aging system, there really is a lot of work that we're doing that we must do to keep that system going. When we start to see the new MMIS developed, we will have a much better handle on the processes that are involved in the management of the program and be able to allocate our resources accordingly from the information that we're getting back out of that system that we're not really able to get in the format that this current MMIS system is giving us. We're going to look for improvement in system performance, and these are some of the metrics that have been developed in the course of the project thus far by our vendor, consultant SAIC Fox. I do not know what SAIC stands for, but they've helped us identify what we would what are the tangible benefits coming off of this system. We would see a reduction in the cost of maintenance and upgrades anytime we try to enhance the current MMIS system. Just by merit of the design of a modern system, we will see that those costs will decrease. We will get greater system flexibility and availability. Many of the duplicative processes that are currently happening in today's environment will be consolidated in the MMIS. We'll see a greater automation of manual processes. A new data system will help us improve the communication and coordination of staff. Really, one of the best things we will get out of this system will be an ability to support rapidly changing Medicaid program requirements. It is nothing if not a dynamic program. And again, as I said earlier, it is very difficult to be as responsive as we would like based on the technology, not by the desire to implement these requirements, but rather it becomes the point of the logjam. The designs of a new MMIS will really allow us to make the changes that we need to make to modify the business rules to now roll out new initiatives in a quicker pace. It will also ensure compliance with state and federal mandates. No small benefit there. The new MMIS will be certified at the state level too, or at the federal level to ensure that we continue to see the kind of matches, the enhanced match that we get from the federal government to administer this program and to operate the data systems. Will help us avoid penalties, maintain the match rates. And just as importantly, stakeholder satisfaction is anticipated to improve with a system that's easier to work with and a little bit more ubiquitous in terms of the interfaces that they will have to the system. It's going to increase the accuracy and the speed of the claims processing and payments, something that I think speaks for itself. Quickly identify the emerging issues as they either anticipate them or as they arise. We can meet them headlong and resolve them in a timely way. Performance standards that a great deal of interest in will also be accurately reported in a way that the current MMIS really wasn't designed to do. So we will be able not only to develop our own reports in the MMIS in an easier way, but also maintain the kind of federal reporting requirements that such a system has associated with it. The eligibility of the client and payment information will be available online in the proposed MMIS replacement. Again, making the most out of the current technologies, permitting providers and other authorized users to, in a very simple way, check the eligibility of the people who are presenting themselves as Medicaid clients, to check on payment information, where their claims are in the process, are all anticipated to be something we'll get in the new system. And it will be HIPAA compliant. The work that's been required to help the MMIS become HIPAA compliant has been a tremendous load for us. The new system will, by merit of the fact that it's modern and easily maintained, we will start to not only meet the current HIPAA requirements, but the new ones as they develop. And I hope in this brief overview that you understand or I've been able to provide the business perspective as to the difficulties of working with the aging and obsolete MMIS.
Thank you. You're Mr. Howard.
Yes, sir.
Correct. Thank you. And I apologize for missing most of your presentation. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Howard? Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before this committee.
What I would like to do now, Madam Chair, is go to page 15 and give you a little sense of the status of the project itself. First of all, in the interest of acronym explanation, HIPAA that Rick mentioned at the end is what I mentioned yesterday, which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And we're going to, if time permitting, we're going to talk a little bit about that toward the end of our time here today. The Medicaid Management Information System Replacement Project is funded about 90% with federal money and about 10% with state money. And a little bit of what we've done here in this past biennium, in April of last year, we completed the business requirements for the new system, and we presented a summary of those to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. And one of the things I would add to that is that the federal government is pretty impressed with what our new system is going to look like and are now suggesting that other states take a look at those business requirements as a potential model for what they might want to do with their own systems as they either replace them or modify them. In September of last year, we completed our cost-benefit analysis of a number of different alternatives for how to implement this system, and we selected an approach that we believe made the most sense for Oregon in terms of where we want to head with the Medicaid program in the future and around cost and what the various stakeholders and users of the system would need. And we presented that approach that we had selected back in September. We presented that to the JLCIMT, and they were supportive. And we've also had some preliminary expression of support from the federal government, which is in the form of what they call CMS, which is their Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the funder of both Medicare and Medicaid. And we're in the process now of working with them to get the next stage of this, which will start in July, to get that funded by them at that 90% level. And we have paperwork and meetings and various things we have to go through with them to get them to approve all that. Basically, what we told the JLCIMT in September that we anticipate doing, as Rick mentioned, is we're going to transfer a system, an existing system, in from another state, which is the same thing that was done in with the system that we have now, and then we would modify that to meet our business needs and whatever we need to do to make the thing work technically in our technical environment. We have several things currently that we outsource, and we believe that continuing to outsource those in the new arrangement would make the most sense, and that's the pharmacy point of sale part of the system and the thing that Rick mentioned, which is the decision support. Sorry, that's not accurate. That's a typo there. It says decision support system. It really is the decision support surveillance and utilization review subsystem. And that's a terrible acronym. But anyway, that one, as Rick mentioned, we're about to outsource that when this project to replace the current one is done, and we would continue to outsource that one. One of the things that's happening in the department as the department moves toward trying to do a better job with collaboration and service delivery and so-called integrated services and that sort of thing is really our data needs are changing. And as I mentioned yesterday, a lot of this, the systems that exist today were developed and implemented in the old divisional and programmatic silos. And so what we really need is an ability to start looking at data, as I said yesterday, across programs, and start being able to look at information across programs that applies to services and that sort of thing that clients are getting. And so one of the things we want to do with the new Medicaid Management Information System is start to use that as a basis for trying to bring some of that stuff together. And so one of the major reasons why we're doing this the way we're doing it is because we want to have what we're calling a unified data approach, and that is we want to use this new system as a basis for getting at that need for the department. Let's see. In April of this year, last month, we completed our plan for how we're going to go to the next step of all this, and that is the procurement of the services to transfer the system in here from another state. One of the things I ought to mention at this point is that one of the requirements of the federal government is that systems that are developed with this kind of money, and the term we use, it's not, the lawyers tell me this isn't quite accurate, but it basically is public domain. And what that means is that any system that was developed with federal money for Medicaid, we can ask another state for, and they have to give it to us for no charge. And so what we pay for, though, is for somebody to help us modify it and bring it in here and do a lot of the transfer and the training and help us figure out data that needs to be converted and how all that's going to work and that, those sorts of services. So what we've done this last month is completed our plan for how we're going to do our procurement for those kind of services and how we're going to figure out the modifications we need and how we're going to implement the new system and that sort of stuff. And as I said a moment ago, we're now working with the federal government to make sure that this all works for their end, since they're from their end, since they're paying 90% for this thing. And what we'll be doing in the upcoming biennium is we'll hopefully get our federal funding approval in a few months, and we're going to have our transfer activities begin in the next biennium. We'll have have the transfer system installed, and we'll begin the work toward the end of the biennium on modifying the transfer system and making it suitable to Oregon's needs. And these dates, I have to say, until we get further into this, are not, they are our best planning estimates at this point. These may change, and we expect if they do change, they would change for the better, and we would get this done more quickly, but some of this will depend on exactly how the procurement for those services works and how quickly we can get contract help, and the state's contracting system is not the most user-friendly, shall I say, and it takes a lot of time to get contracting done in this state. And so some of those dates we expect expect to improve, but we're not sure how much yet until we get further into this.
Mr. Cuddy, it sounds like you're pretty confident about obtaining the federal funding.
Madam Chair, yes, we have every reason to believe they've been very supportive up till now, and the conversations we've had with them, we have every reason to believe they'll continue to support us.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you. Again, I apologize for being late as well. The cost, estimated cost total of the system, and then what would be included in the 0305 budget? I may have missed that earlier in your presentation.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, we did not talk about cost yet, so you didn't miss it. I'm not sure we can give you a total cost, because some of this will depend on what kind of prices we get from vendors to do work for us as we go through our procurements. What we is currently, and Sheila, you may want to help me with this, but what's currently in the policy package is $70.6 million for the upcoming, for the 2003-05 biennium, of which approximately $7.5 million would be state money. But
that's a projected budget.
Pardon?
A projected
budget. Yes. But we have been in conversations with LFO and with BAM, and Pam, you may want to help with this too, about changing that number and also potentially funding this in a different way. And I maybe the...
Madam Chair,
please.
Senator Morse, right now, if you approve the governor's budget, the total cost of the project to date through the end of the 03-05 biennium would be almost $100 million total funds. That's not fully to completion, so there's some additional amounts on top of that. But the discussion point for 03-05, as noted in the governor's budget, it was $70.6 million total funds, of which $7.5 million is general fund. Our discussion and what's in the co-chair's budget would instead of funding the $7.5 million general fund for the project, it would anticipate issuing certificates of participation for the state share of the project, both for the work to be done this biennium and then towards the end of the biennium for the work to be done next biennium. So we would be looking at it about an 11.3 million certificate of participation over the next biennium, but the general fund bill, if you will, for 03-05, the debt service on that would be 1.5 million in 03-05. Now, in 05-07, it will be somewhat higher. I didn't bring the numbers, but I think it's about 4 or 5 million, and then there's some debt service after that. So it's a little bit more general fund cost overall, but by using the certificates of participation, we better match the state's investment with the expenditures and over a longer time period because the system will be used for a while. So we're using a model with this that would be similar to how the juvenile justice information system was developed, using certificates of participation to get that statewide system up and running. And then there's been some other information systems funded similarly. So that's what, at this point anyway, the co-chair's budget anticipates those certificates of participation being used in the 03-05 biennium, and basically that would represent the state's remaining share of funding for the project for the next few years until implementation.
Senator Morris? Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, that's all that we were going to talk about related to MMIS. Now, let's see. There's a couple of options here. One, in the interest of time, I could just stop if you'd like me to. We also, what I did is I, from yesterday, there were some of the IT, the challenges that we faced that I did not finish, which I skipped to start on MMIS. I could go back to that if you would like. Also, in the remainder of the presentation, there are a number of the other initiatives that we're in the midst of right now that I could also talk about. So it's whatever the pleasure is of the committee at this point.
I would suggest that we go back to the IT challenges and complete that piece.
Okay. Be happy to.
If you'll direct us to...
And I can actually go through this. We'll try to go through this fairly quickly for you. Get my notes organized here if I can for a minute.
And what page are we looking at?
We are looking at page 11. One of the major challenges we face these days has to do with security. After September 11, as you know, everybody's conscious, more conscious of that than ever. And unfortunately, the kinds of security methodologies that we have built into these old systems that I talked about yesterday are old, and they don't necessarily protect us very well from some of the what people can do these days. And many of them are awkward to use, are built in directly into the programs rather than sitting in front of the programs to try to protect our systems. Secretary of State has done some audits where they've been very critical about the department's security, and we've been working here over the last few years especially to try to improve it. And we did put a firewall, which is basically a filter that sits in front of certain systems that prevents certain people or certain certain people from getting in. We put a firewall a couple of years ago into an application operated by the Public Health Lab in Portland around HIV information and its sensitivity to try to protect that. That was a little over 2 years ago. A couple of years ago, we put in a general firewall to protect all of our systems and also some intrusion detection software, which is supposed to alert us if somebody does manage to get through that firewall or try to. And we have a lot more work to do in this area, and we're currently in the midst of defining policies and procedures around security to try to take the next step. And a lot of this, the policies really have to be driven by the business risk that the programs and the business side of the department is willing to take on. One of the examples I always use is, you know, we could have everybody enter 10 passwords and have a pretty well-protected thing, but who wants to enter 10 passwords? And so you get a trade-off about how much burden you put on users to have them do stuff around security versus how protected you need to be. Another point I want to make also about security is this is not all information technology. It has to do with not letting people look at screens, keeping file cabinets locked, and things like that. So data security is a lot more than just information technology. So that's kind of where we are on that. And I guess the last point, two other points, is that the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, has some pretty stringent security requirements that we're going to have to comply with. And we're part of our planning right now has to do with figuring out how we're going to comply with the security part of that.
Can you give some examples of what's required?
I'm not sure I can give you any specifics. Is there anybody here who, Kristen, do you know?
I don't.
Let's see if I've got anything in my notes. Well, Madam Chair, basically, I can tell you that HIPAA requires that health information be protected, and when it's electronic, we have to make sure that we have security stuff in place when we send it somewhere to make sure that people can't intercept it and things like that. But also, there again, with HIPAA, there are security things that are not just IT, that are the kind of things I mentioned a couple of minutes ago around making sure that, I mean, I know when I went in a doctor's office here a year ago or so, I was standing there at the counter, and there were a bunch of health records sitting there and of other people sitting there on the counter that I could have looked at if I'd wanted to, and it's that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. The budget to meet the security needs isn't included in the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I believe that is right.
And is there a cost that you could attach to bringing the security systems current?
Madam Chair, yes, there is. I don't have that in my head, but, yeah, there is. We have done some estimates of that.
It would be good to know what investment would be required, particularly to meet the all of the confidentiality requirements that you have described to us.
Okay, we'd be happy to get that for you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And where would you like to go next?
Okay, if we could continue on page 11. Just a few quick things about one of the other challenges we face is that, as is always the case, technology keeps changing on us. One of the things that's happening is that things are getting increasingly complex. The advent of the Internet and the World Wide Web and all that has created both a lot of opportunities for people to have access to data and for us to make information available publicly that was not very easy to make available in the past. And ultimately, it presents a lot of opportunities for us to improve services, but it also has, along with it, problems about security and who should have access to what, and it makes life considerably more complicated at the same time that it presents us with opportunities to do good things. We have the ongoing thing that I talked a little bit about yesterday about how do we deal with all these unintegrated systems in a world that's heading toward needing data that's more integrated. That's making our lives a lot more complex. There are new technologies that are coming out, what is loosely called mobile computing, things like Palm Pilots that connect to the Internet. One of our applications, our newer systems called Oregon Access, and Access is an acronym, and I can't for the life of me remember what that stands for now because it was created about 8 years ago.
It'll come to you at 3 a.m. this morning.
Yes, I'm sure.
Tomorrow morning.
But Oregon Access, we pretty creatively use laptop computers so people can go out, and that's a system that serves our seniors and disabled services programs in SPD. And people can go out and meet with clients with their laptop and take information and then come back and load it into the system. And so we have a lot of these new kinds of technologies that we're trying to figure out how to use and where it's appropriate to use them. And in some cases, frankly, it isn't appropriate. But that also increases the complexity of what we have to deal with. In the application development area, one of the problems we have is this, you know, when I buy a new car, I get rid of my old one, usually, unless my son manages to twist my arm. And unfortunately, in information technology, it seems like nothing goes away. And we've got mainframe applications, and we pile on top of them client-server applications, and now we're about to pile on top of them web applications, and we talked some again about that yesterday also. And excuse me, and because of that, that makes our lives a lot more complicated because we now have a new thing coming along that we have to sort of put on top of all the old stuff that hasn't gone away. A couple of other things we did talk about yesterday. We talked about open-source software, and we talked about, I'm on the top of page 12 now. We talked about the fact that because of the way the computer and hardware and software manufacturers work, particularly around personal computers and that sort of stuff, we can't just stand still, that they force obsolescence on us and stop supporting old products. And they almost force us over time to move to new stuff. And that's a real challenge for us. The final one that I put on here, because certainly in times of shrinking and tight resources, everybody thinks, gee, let's outsource things. And I put that on here because I thought it might be worth talking to you about that for a few minutes. I guess just a couple of points from my end. You know, when I worked for one of the main major computer vendors, very briefly, I was managing a unit in that company that was selling outsourcing services. I got another assignment, which is why it changed fairly quickly, but was selling outsourcing services to state and local government. So I've got a little bit of experience with this in one of my past lives. And I guess the point I would make to you about outsourcing is that it really depends on the situation you're in. You don't always save money when you have somebody else outside a private entity do your IT work, your information technology work. And it really depends on what your service needs are and what your own cost model looks like. Because, for instance, our computer center runs pretty lean. And there was a study done about 10 years ago, maybe a little more now. It hasn't been updated, but that said that the DHS computer center was the leanest one in state government and, in fact, was more lean than most of them, as I recall being told, most of them in the private sector. And so if you wanted to talk about outsourcing that particular computer center by itself, the cost model might not be there for saving costs. Now, you might have some very valid reasons for doing it around service, and as I mentioned yesterday a little bit, around recovering from a disaster, around security of your computer center. There may be some reasons for going to outsourcing that don't relate to cost, but everybody tends to jump to cost as the reason for wanting to look at outsourcing, and the facts are that it doesn't always save you money. Having said that, I would also say that there are a number of things that our department either already does outsource or is planning to outsource. I mentioned in the Medicaid Management Information System for the Medicaid program, the point of sale and the surveillance and utilization review subsystem. We're about to outsource that one. We already do point of sale. Our electronic benefits transfer is outsourced. We buy maintenance for our personal computers and printers from outside contractors. A lot of our significant amount of our development work is outsourced to the private sector. Oregon Access, which I mentioned a few moments ago, was done almost entirely by an outside company that produced that system for us. And so we do that where we think it's appropriate, and we always look at other ways, other areas where we might think it's appropriate. And I did mention yesterday that I'm involved in this statewide group and chairing the statewide subcommittee that's working looking at outsourcing of computer centers and or consolidation of computer centers. And outsourcing is one of the things that we're looking at as an option there. Now, when I said that it might not make sense to outsource the DHS computer center because of the economics of it, that doesn't necessarily mean that if you put all the state computer centers together that there might not be an economic benefit there. We're not sure yet. So,
Mr. Cuddy,
yes.
you have a statement here that says the outsourcing decision should include looking at a balance between good service and profit?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
And so have we struck that balance?
Madam Chair, I believe we have on those ones that are mentioned there that are at the bottom of the page, where we have made a decision on those things that we can get the service we need and have somebody else provide it to us, and at a price that's decent for us. That's an individual decision that really, each time you look at it, you have to take a look at that and make that choice.
I see.
With that, the remainder of the presentation is to, let's see, I'm on page 16, and what I can do here quickly is talk about some of these other initiatives that we have. The WIC Information System Tracker, which is now called TWIST, which is actually an acronym within an acronym.
That's double money.
It is. Right.
I beat you. Senator Carter, I beat
you. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. I won't do that anymore.
We need all the help we need.
All right.
This is a project that we have going on. We're at the tail end of it now to replace our system that serves the Women, Infants, and Children's Program. And the new system, this is 100% federal money. The new system was put into pilot in Hood River and Clackamas counties in February of this year. The pilot's going very well. We'll be rolling it out over the rest of the year from June to October. It should be statewide in October, and we're doing some development as we go on about around some reporting and stuff of that sort, but it's pretty close to being finished. A couple of things I noted on here that we're finding from benefits from the pilot is that client appointments with the new system are taking less time, so those people in those county health offices that deliver the WIC program are finding that, so far at least through the pilot in those couple of places, that it allows staff more time to see clients. And there's a misstatement here. In the second bullet, it says automatic appointment scheduling saved 3 days of staff time at Clackamas during May. What that really should say is the scheduling that they did for May, they saved three times on their scheduling of client appointments. I looked at that yesterday, and I thought, how can we have saved time in May when it's April? So, anyway, my apologies for that. But they are finding that they're saving time, and if that holds, they think they'll be able to, if that holds long term, they think they'll have more time available to increase their client service. The next one we'd like to talk about is called EXPRESS, is the acronym, the EXPRESS Payment and Reporting System. And actually, I want to be sensitive to your time. We have someone from the program side here to take 5 minutes or so and tell you why we're doing this, and it's related to the Staley decision. If that's all right, I'd like to ask Jack Morgan to come up for just tell you quickly why we're
Certainly.
Into this.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Morgan. I'm the manager for program development and seniors and people with disabilities. But I'm actually here today to talk about three other programs, mental health services, alcohol and drug services, and developmental disability service, and represent their business interests around a payment system. These programs were organized for many years under the Mental Health Division and shared some central administrative services, including a payment system. These are primarily payments that go to county governments and subcontractors of county governments. It does not include payments distributed through the Oregon Health Plan. The payments that are currently made through this system total about $800 million per biennium. The core of this system that we're currently using is based on 25-year-old technology. It's called a Client Process Monitoring System, or CPMS. It was originally developed as a database to collect encounter data to follow clients and look at the amount of services they received over the years. In 1981, that changed because the federal government offered states an opportunity to apply for home and community-based waivers where they could collect Medicaid dollars for as an alternative to payments that went to institutions. And at that time, the state was also going through another major budget crisis. Oregon jumped on it as fast as we could and were the first state in the country to get waiver plans approved at that point. But we needed a payment system to support that effort, and we didn't have either the time or money to develop a new system. So the current CPMS system, even though it wasn't designed as a payment system, was reformatted in a way that would allow payments to occur. About 10 years after that, we had to include another database system, a commercial product, an R-base system is what it was called, and it would augment the payment system to help the division manage its funds. The manufacturer of that product has since gone out of business, so we do not have product support anymore for that system. Based on the technology that's available, this is a very cumbersome system. It puts a lot of stress on our business partners. The claim cycle takes 2 to 3 months to complete. If there are changes or adjustments that need to be made, they can be made during that window of time. If they don't happen then the adjustments are paid off until there's a year-end settlement, which is a very, very labor-intensive kind of process that providers will tell you can sometimes take years to complete. There's virtually no or very limited electronic access to this system. For the most part, it's a paper pen kind of an operation. Forms come into the state, and the state workers put the information into the system. But the providers and the counties cannot get information out of the system. They can't query the system to manage their business activity.
The Senator Carter.
Just a question,
yes.
Please.
Sure.
I even heard Mr. Cuddy mention in his remarks, but yours as well, and he was talking about, I'm using the term antiquated system of that you have and how you're having to accommodate with systems that they were not designed to accommodate. How then, what's the mechanism by which you use? Does it mean that it, what is the impact of it? Does it mean that you're slower at getting things out to counties or to serve the people? What's the impact?
The impact is that the systems don't, because they weren't designed to perform this way, they don't perform very well. So they're very slow. Mm-hmm. And that, for the counties and providers, that creates a lot of cash flow problems. It creates a lack of information that they need for managing their services. It's poor performance.
And if I could add to that, Madam Chair and Senator Carter, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, John.
This thing, the technology that is used for this thing, as Jack said, is ancient, and it is not supported by the manufacturers anymore. And we've got $800 million in payments every biennium that are riding on a system that is literally in danger of crashing. And we have to replace this thing. It is technically just really bad.
Question? Can I just follow up one more?
You betcha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I wanted to ask that question, I kind of knew it for the sake of the committee, because John went through all of this stuff in 1999. We couldn't even accommodate the Y2K system because we didn't have the money to rebuild at that time, right. Let alone buy. And here they are still these many years later trying to deal with these systems. It just appeared to me that if we're going to accommodate our constituencies in our different communities when their checks are late, or because the county couldn't get it out, because the state couldn't get it out, that somewhere along the line that some kind of something needs to happen in terms of financing. Are grants available along these lines, John?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, this system actually gets 90% federal money.
Oh, does it?
Yes. It's considered part of MMIS, believe it or not. And so we get 90% federal money for this, and that's
so
helped us a lot.
The problem is that the state has not dedicated any, so you can go to next step.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative Smith.
So how much is the new system going to cost?
I believe, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I think it's about $150,000 in general fund for the coming biennium.
Would that be 10%?
Yes. So whatever that.
$1.5 million.
Approximately. I think that's right. Does anybody?
Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, I don't have that precise number, but I would note in the governor's budget there is some staffing continued for this system that was approved for the 2001-03 biennium. They had some problems recruiting as limited duration staff, which was what was approved. So it was during the interim those staff were changed to permanent positions. They've recruited, and so the project is moving along slower, and there's not additional funding other than the staffing included in the governor's budget specifically for this project. But there are at least some resources that they have available towards.
So then it sounds, like the timeline that we're looking at is in jeopardy then, because the information in front of us says that you're planning for completion by December 2004. You won't be able to meet that.
Madam Chair, what I think the department will need to do is change some priorities in order to be able to free up some money to finish the system.
You'll make it happen.
And I think that's what we think we need to do. And by the way, I do have the accurate number on the budget. My apologies for not having it in my head. It's what we believe it'll cost is $2.1 million for the upcoming biennium, total funds.
Representative Smith.
Well, if you're telling me that what you're doing by hand is labor intensive and you have all these people pushing papers around, would there be a savings in labor costs that you could apply towards the purchase of the computer system? And have you ever written out a proposal to make it palatable for us to look at? I mean, we know we're all in tight budget times, and that's a question. And then another little side note here. You know, during the 90s, we had huge expansions of government, and, you know, it was a lot of freewheeling and spending in this building. And I'm a little bit appalled by the fact that we didn't invest in our infrastructures. And the time that you invest in your infrastructures is during good economic times when you have the money to do it. I don't necessarily think that's the time that you necessarily invest in adding employees, which I think probably went on with this agency. I don't know. I'm just making an assumption here. But that's when you do it. And I think maybe they were a little gun-shy over what happened with the last computer purchase at the state. That they, you know, I think maybe we all, who were serving in the legislature then, didn't want to touch a new computer system after with what happened with that, because everybody got beat up so bad by it. And, boy, I can certainly understand that. But so, if you know, if you could answer that first question.
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith, the system is being designed and developed at this point, and we are anticipating that at the completion of this, as of the development, we would not need some of the positions that are currently involved in processing the current claims. The new system will probably need some staffing in order to be maintained. What the net difference is, I don't know at this time. But we've talked with staff, and people are well aware that that's where we're going.
Okay. Thank you.
So one other
we need
point. Just a note of urgency with this. I think John does represent there is a risk at this point because of the age of the equipment. The other issue for us is this daily settlement agreement. And there is an increased caseload and claim volume associated with that settlement that makes it even more important that we get the system changed and have a new system to move to in order to accommodate that, because that caseload will probably overwhelm the system.
Madam Chair, I'm concerned about other folks who need to follow me in your time, and if it's okay, I'd like to stop. And there were two other things on here that I hope are fairly self-explanatory, and if members of the committee have questions or things they'd like me to, I'd be happy to talk to you individually, or we could get back to the committee with other information if there's more you'd like. So if it's okay with you.
Additional questions or comments, then we will move forward.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Appreciate your work. Okay, I believe next it's Margie Johnson, Finance and Policy Analysis. Good afternoon to you.
Thank you.
Good to see you back, too.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margie Johnson, and I'm the Acting Assistant Director for Finance and Policy Analysis for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to give you an overview of this part of the department's budget and the functions that we're responsible for performing on behalf of the department. The main things that we are responsible for include budget development and monitoring, caseload forecasting, rate setting for long-term care programs at this point, federal policy monitoring for potential or actual impact on the department's programs, federal fund leveraging, and after the reorganization and the change in duties for the Continuous System Improvement Program, we have taken on responsibilities for performance measurement. In your notebook on page 4-11, behind the tab that says Finance and Policy, is an organization chart that shows how we've grouped our staff to perform these functions. We basically have formed this operation in the consolidated department after the reorg in order to consolidate the department's approach to both budgeting and to forecasting. As you've heard before, in the administrative area, there were each division had its own separate administrative support, and that was true in the budget area and as well as forecasting. What we've done is in our reorganization, we've consolidated those budget shops from 7 down to 4. And what we've tried to do, and you can see on the organization chart, that we have 4 separate budget areas that relate to the particular program clusters. We want to maintain close linkages with those programs so that folks who are doing the budgeting for them and the forecasting for them understand what is involved in those programs and can be in support of the program and the staff that work in those policy clusters. In our caseload forecasting, we've likewise centralized and strengthened that effort. The first area that we looked at were the Oregon Health Plan caseloads because, obviously, of the magnitude of the business that's involved there and the fact that we needed a predictable and reliable way to look at history and come up with forecasts that folks are confident take into account the various changes and actual historical trends that have developed in the health plan caseload. So, for example, we take into account 7 years of history, and the data is categorized by essentially by individual eligible, so that an analysis can be done of the of the movement of eligible folks into the system, out at the length of time they stay in a particular eligibility category, and the amount of time that then would be before we would expect them to leave the program. So that we've been able to accomplish within the last couple of years with some help from consultation with Willamette University. And we now have a program that gives us a baseline projection that we are confident is taking into account the history of that program. We then have the ability to make judgments about what we anticipate the impact of policy changes would be on that baseline forecast, so that we can go through issue by issue and make adjustments as necessary. One of the things that we have done and are incorporating into the caseload forecast is the impact of moving to the OHP2 package of services and the subsequent impact that we would estimate on the caseload. So we've been able to, or our goal is to maintain contact with program, have folks involved in these budgeting and caseload forecasting decisions, and then provide us a centralized and coordinated approach to these services. Some of the things that we've accomplished over this the course of this biennium is fairly intense work. Our budget folks have worked closely with our accounting folks to consolidate the budgets of the former divisions into one agency structure. So we've gone from essentially seven, from an accounting perspective and a budgeting perspective, from seven separate entities into one. We've implemented a federally approved cost allocation plan that is applicable to all of the programs in the department now. We've implemented a department-wide monthly expenditure tracker and have made that available online to managers so that they can we can see across the department where we are in terms of our expenditures as monitored against our budget at a detailed level. And we also have put in place a comprehensive tracking document that allows us to track our revenues. We have upwards of 125 separate other fund revenue sources and I think around 75 different federal fund sources that we're responsible for monitoring. I think that one of the things that we're going to be moving toward in the forecasting area is expanding our role beyond the health plan into long-term care. We are currently assisting the seniors and people with disabilities cluster with their long-term care caseload forecast. And we will likewise start working with the child welfare and self-sufficiency caseload forecasts. One of the other main areas that we have tried to provide support to both the department and to our county partners and other state agencies and other entities is assisting in leveraging Medicaid funds from the federal government. Because the department is the state Medicaid agency, Medicaid financing Medicaid funding needs to come through the department. But there are services that are provided elsewhere in state government and also in other situations such as in school districts on behalf of Medicaid-eligible folks and that would be eligible for a Medicaid match. And we're working with school districts, currently eight of them, and other agencies to leverage Medicaid financing for a total of about a little over $38 million in federal funds for this biennium that we've been able to claim using federally approved claiming mechanisms for these eligible services. Examples would be services that are funded in schools, school-based medical services, and some of the administrative functions that school districts perform on behalf of Medicaid-eligible children. We also have worked with the tribes, the federally recognized tribes, to help with federal financing of targeted case management for tribal members. And also we've been doing some work with counties to provide an opportunity for them to augment services to targeted individuals through Medicaid financing. And we're also involved with administrative cost claiming for four of the nine federally recognized tribes. To support these efforts, the governor's budget requests one new position that would provide support specifically to school districts and in leveraging Medicaid. The activities that we need to perform, or the school and the school district needs to perform in order to document those services that are eligible, are fairly labor intensive. We need to come up with a mechanism to analyze and then document the amount of time that would be claimable. And it's fairly, especially at the front end, is fairly administratively complex. And we've been working closely with the Department of Education, especially with their special education folks, to put together this proposal, which would increase our ability by one FTE, and it's financed with a combination of other funds, which would be a small portion of the amount that the school districts are currently spending on these services, and then matched at a 50-50 rate with federal funds to support those endeavors. The other thing that our office has tried to do is to provide support to the field structure in the department through a statewide transportation initiative. We also have tried to put effort into supporting the volunteer program that is operating across the state. In the transportation initiatives, we have currently, there are four medical transportation brokerages that are financed through the Medicaid program that are serving folks in 17 counties right now. And several more are in the planning stages. I think our challenges over this biennium have been to affect the changes that have been required because of the reorganization, at the same time maintaining a good contact, close contact with our programs so that we can provide the kind of support they need and monitoring their budget and tracking their expenditures. That summarizes my presentation. If you have questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
You're welcome. Madam Chair, Jean Thorne, Director of the Department of Human Services. I wanted to just very briefly mention the list that you have and how we approach that, and then just try to wrap up all of the department's budget. I did talk with Senator Winters yesterday about the list for department-wide support services. It is not in priority order. What we have, and I'll explain the rationale for that in a moment. What we have done is in the various parts of department-wide support services, tried to kind of break out the various subunits so you can have a sense of the dollars and FTE associated with them. The reason this is not in a priority order is that in almost all cases, department-wide support services and the need for those services will be affected by the program decisions that are made. And so if there are, if the program decisions that are made, for instance, on the health plan, if there are a lot fewer clients being served, that will affect the imaging services. That
If there's more complicated programs, that may affect our need for information technology services. If we end up with a lot fewer staff, that may affect how many staff we need in human resources. So as I had talked to Senator Winters yesterday, we thought it would be more useful as we move through work session, as program decisions are made, then we need to look at what the specific effect on department-wide support services might be and tease those out. So I don't plan on going through those lists, but they are available for you. Again, I think that probably will be more helpful as we look at programs and then look at the specific effects on various parts of department-wide support services from that. Let me just take a few minutes, if I might, to kind of wrap up the last 3 months that we've been here. I hope you've had the opportunity to learn about the Department of Human Services and the programs and services that we provide. We spent some time talking about the services that are provided to children and families, specifically those that are designed to keep kids safe, whether it's an abuse investigation, providing services in the home to keep children, to provide the skills or supports to parents so that they can keep children in their home, or to provide foster care adoption placement to them. Within that, we also talked about the services that are provided to help families become self-sufficient. So temporary assistance to needy families, food stamps, the various work that's done in our jobs programs to help people secure employment and to retain employment. After that, you heard about our field structure, community human services. Primarily, those are the state staff who operate those services to children and families, but also include state staff who provide services to seniors and persons with disabilities. Within the umbrella of community human services, you also heard about the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, whose goal is to help persons with disabilities become employable. You then moved on to health services for, I believe, many days. So you heard about population-based public health services. They're designed to protect the health of the public at large in Oregon, whether it's the detection and prevention of communicable diseases, environmental health, bioterrorism, preventive services, and programs for children, adolescents, and adults. You heard from the Office of Medical Assistance Programs and received, I think it was either a Medicaid or a health plan 101 of who we cover, what we cover, how we cover it, the cost drivers, the important role that the Oregon Health Plan really plays for clients throughout the Department of Human Services. It is the program that is used most heavily throughout the department. You heard about mental health and addiction services, prevention programs, treatment programs, the role of our state institutions in providing services to those who have mental health issues. You then moved on to services to seniors and persons with disabilities in our seniors and people with disabilities cluster. And in there, James Taves and his staff talked about the long-term care service system, the continuum of care that we provide from in-home care to nursing home care. Really, that's kind of Oregon's groundbreaking system of supports. You heard also about services to the developmentally disabled, whether they're institutional or community-based. And then this week we talked with you about the services that supports all of that, leadership and support that's provided through the director's office, administrative services, information technology, and finance and policy analysis. So I guess over these 3 months, I hope we've been able to provide you with some sense of the breadth of the services we provide, the impact of those services on Oregonians. Going back to, I think, one of the first days I was with you, almost 1 million Oregonians a year receive one or more services from the Department of Human Services, so it touches the lives of many Oregonians. There's an economic impact of those services. As I noted at the beginning, 80% of our budget goes out to the community, whether it's to health care providers, nursing home providers, foster care providers, county-operated programs, or services to clients, so or benefits to clients. So it is very much a budget that has a direct economic impact on our communities. You probably heard more than you wanted to know about federal and legal constraints that guide the choices that we have to make or can make. I think, you know, going back to one of the pie charts the first day, of our general fund, only 13% of it is unmatched or not federal maintenance of effort, which means only 13% of our dollars don't have some kind of federal string attached. So that is a concern. I mean, it's great that we're leveraging, but on the other hand, it means we have less control over many of the decisions. Most of all, I hope that you have been able to get an understanding of the interrelationship of the services throughout the department. We do have clients who may have mental health issues but receive services from other parts of the department as well. I hope you also were able to get some sense of sometimes if you talk about the balloon, you push one place and it pops out someplace else of understanding, and that's always a challenge for us as we go through program reductions. Are these people going to show up or their needs show up somewhere else in our service system? So I guess I would just like to say I recognize the difficult, very difficult choices that you're going to have before you as you move into work session on our budget. It's the last few months have been very difficult for all of us, and I think that coming in, well, I was new, January 1, but not so new. I think as we've had to deal with the decisions that we had to make, whether it was in the December allotment reductions or Measure 28 cuts, one of the things that I often heard was, oh, we're putting the most vulnerable people out. Well, in fact, anyone who comes into human services, by and large, is there because they have some vulnerability, they have some need. And the decisions that have been made to date are very difficult and have been difficult and directly affect people, and you've seen that. And there are more of those decisions ahead. As you move into work session, we look forward to working with you and trying to help analyze the impacts of the various decisions that you will have to make, so that as we leave this building, hopefully we will all understand. We may not be able to accept, but we will understand the implications of the decisions that are being made. So with that, I'd just like to thank you for your attention over the last 3 months as we've been here with you discussing our various programs. And if there are any questions or comments that you would like to make.
First of all, thank you very much for the quality of presentations and information, and also for the quality of your leadership, the leadership you brought to the organization. And I think you've gotten a sense of how this is a committee that very much wants to be in partnership with you in the department in the days and months ahead. It is going to be tough, but this is work that we're all committed to taking on together on behalf of Oregonians. With that said, looking back over the time that we've spent together, I don't believe we spent as much time as we could have, should have, on the affirmative action piece and what the organization looks like now and where it's headed. There's a wonderful document in our notebook that captures where the organization is now in numbers and categories. The document also captures some of the work and commitment of the previous administration, Bobby Mink, Donnie Griffin, and a lot of their great efforts to bring new thinking to this whole area that we call diversity and diversifying our workforce, et cetera. I happen to know, Gene Thorne, that you're greatly committed to this notion of affirmative action and making it work. Perhaps during the work session, part of our work, if you could look at bringing us a statement that shares your analysis of where the organization is now, because with these layoffs and cutbacks, a lot of the gains in affirmative action for women and for people of color and for people with disabilities will, in fact, be lost. So what will that what does that picture look like now? And I know from reviewing one of the documents in the affirmative action section of our notebook that we know that we were challenged in upper-middle management, for example, with the numbers of people of color and the number of people with disabilities being below goal. And we know that when we look at the number of professionals, people of color, people with disabilities, again, we are currently below goal. Technicians, people of color, below goal, though not as significantly in as in the other two categories I just mentioned. Paraprofessionals, again, below goal, particularly for people with disabilities. Skilled craft, people of color, people with disabilities, below goal. And even in the service maintenance area, people with disabilities, below goal. So, again, therein lies not just a challenge, but also an opportunity. How are we going to manage in this area? And what is our commitment in this area? And how do we move ourselves forward with regard to affirmative action? So just want to put that out there.
And Madam Chair, it's very timely. We just had a discussion, was it Monday, at Cabinet with our affirmative action officer, and the data he had was before all of the changes that have occurred in the layoffs. And he is rerunning that information, and we'll be coming back, and we're going to have a more of a focused discussion on, given where we are and given what we project in terms of openings, which is a little hard to project right now, but what are some actions we can take to have a workforce that better reflects those we serve. And so we began that discussion this week, and we'll be continuing that, and so we'll plan on having more in-depth of a discussion with you during work session.
And then lastly, for me, I would just like to commend the department for the report on gender-appropriate services. Wonderful document. Lots of progress, and in looking over the information, again, I wish that there were a way to get the good story out to a broader audience, because there are some exciting things happening that you've captured here, again, in the document. Thank you. Senator Carter or Senator Morris?
Thank you. Jean, as you look at the future, what are the greatest opportunities for improvement?
I'm trying to think beyond one day at a time right now. I think, and obviously much of there are resource issues. There are areas of improvement tied to resources, and there are areas of improvement tied to behaviors. I think that obviously there is much more we would like to be able to do with information technology, and that we need to do with information technology. You heard some of the priority projects here today. I think that Senator Winters yesterday expressing, was it yesterday? I think I was just watching on TV the frustration around central records. That certainly is something we'd like to be able to do, given the various program cuts that we've made. Some of those things have gone by the wayside. But I think we need to continue to look to see what can we do in a resource-constricted environment. I think within the department, and I've coming back in January and having seen where we are in reorganization. Again, I think we've got a really good leadership team in place now and a committed team to look at how can we, with a centralized administrative services you've heard about this week, how can we continue to find efficiencies? How can we make sure that they are there to support programs? So how can we better link in this reorganized world with programs? I think on the ground, my sense is, and I did mention this when we started out with the department's presentation 3 months ago, I think we may have gotten mixed up what our goals were, and that reorganization became a goal in itself, when really, a specific model of reorganization became a goal. And I think that what we need to be able to do is say, how can we on the ground do a better job working across the agency and with other partners to deliver better and more integrated services to clients? And that may be with partners inside the state or local partners. It may look different in different places. And I met last week with the we have each of our service delivery areas has a review committee of partners, and a representative from each of them came, and we talked about, as everyone says, my three questions: what's working well and should continue, and what could work well but we need some changes, and what do we need to rethink. And I think one of the comments one of the people there made, and I've heard a similar comment before, is that a lot of service integration was already happening, and efforts were happening, and the train was going down the track, and then suddenly the caboose came and said, oh, wait a minute, this is the way it needs to be done. And so in some ways it may have hindered some of the more natural linkages that we could could occur. So I think there are things, even in the limited resource environment, we need to and can sit down with our partners inside the department, our county partners of services that are actually delivered through are funded through the department, and other groups. For instance, this morning the community action directors were here, and say, given what we have left to work with, how can we fit this together? So I think one of the things that's certainly impressed me in the months that I've been back, especially given the very difficult reductions that have been made, is the commitment our workforce has. We've got 9,000, I don't know if we have 9,500 or 8,500 on any given day employees, and so many of them have expressed to me that even though these are tough times, they're committed to helping people and to try to make this work. So I think we've got a committed group of people working in our agency, and we need to really take advantage of that. And in times that aren't so hopeful, at least be able to spark that creativity and to help people recognize that there are things that we can do in the work site, there are things we can do with our partners that may not cost more money and may save us money. So that's there are a whole lot of other things that it's going to depend on what we end up with by the time we're done with this session. And I know there are more reductions likely still on the horizon for us, and we'll have to figure out where we go from there.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a comment. The position that we're in, we're largely insulated from this process, save for our interfacing with our constituents, and I share a concern that not only dealing with the financial exigencies and less money, but the overlay of the PERS issue and the lack of uncertainty. And I met with a pretty large group of public employees yesterday evening, and I think we as legislators need to be very sensitive to the morale issue that you're faced with, because it isn't just a matter of doing more with less. It's actually over the PERS issue, yes, overlaid over the top of it, compounds your task immensely. And so I have sensitivity to that. You know, we need to be wise stewards and and hard-nosed to a certain extent, but I appreciate what your people are going through in trying to hold an organization together and the morale challenges that you have.
Thank you.
And just share that with you.
That's very important to us. Thank you. Yes.
Please do take a message back to all of our employees that tells them that their work is appreciated, valued, and as Senator Morris has indicated, that lets our employees know that we are concerned about the morale and the conditions that they are working in and through right now. And again, that their work is appreciated, much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I will do that. Thank you.
And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 5030, and we are also adjourned.
Thank you.